This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, April 5th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, we'll chat with an author of a ghost thriller set in the Four Corners region ahead of her book presentation this evening in Westminster. Using garbage to break ties with Russia? That story and more on H2O Radio's This Week in Water. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth. On this week's science show, host Joel Parker speaks with Dr. Emily Levesque. She'll be giving a talk later this week at CU's Fisk Planetarium. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Governor Jared Polis signed the Reproductive Health Equity Act yesterday, which affirms access to abortion and contraception in Colorado. The law also bans local governments from restricting or interfering with an individual's right to reproductive care and says that a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus does not have independent or derivative rights. The legislation passed along party lines after facing heavy Republican opposition, including a close to 24-hour Republican-led filibuster that made Colorado history. Supporters sought passage in response to a Mississippi case heard before the United States Supreme Court that threatens to overrule Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court landmark decision that banned states from outlawing abortion. The Associated Press reports Colorado was the first state to decriminalize abortion in most cases in 1967, but before yesterday had nothing in state law guaranteeing the right to abortion. Colorado joins New Jersey, Oregon, and Vermont in codifying the right to abortion throughout pregnancy. This according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research organization that supports abortion rights. Charges were dropped on a man accused of starting the 2018 spring fire in southern Colorado. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
Jesper Jorgensen, a Danish man in the country without proper documentation, was arrested on June 28, 2018, and accused of starting the spring fire. Nine News reports that he was charged with 141 counts of arson as the fire burned more than 108,000 acres and destroyed more than 140 homes. Castilla County Judge Gregory Lyman dropped charges Monday against Jorgensen. Prosecutors said last month that Jorgensen had been found incompetent to proceed on multiple occasions, and the Castilla County Sheriff's Office didn't have the resources to restore him to competency through forced medication. The 12th Judicial District Attorney's Office said they had wanted to work with the Department of Homeland Security to place Jorgensen in their custody. Judge Lyman had hoped Jorgensen, who was accused of starting the fire while cooking food outside, would be deported if the charges were dropped. Lyman said the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had no intention of doing that. An ICE spokesman had said Monday morning that the agency was awaiting information on the case. It wasn't clear what would happen to Jorgensen after his release from the state mental hospital in Pueblo on Monday. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
State lawmakers introduced a bipartisan bill last week that, if passed into law, will prohibit the sale of products containing pulverocerol and polyfluorocerol substances, otherwise known as forever chemicals or PFAS. Researchers have linked forever chemicals to cancer and birth defects and would begin enforcing the ban beginning January 1, 2024. According to the Denver Post, the Environmental Working Group released an analysis last year claiming the discharge of PFAS chemicals has compromised 500-plus water sources in Colorado. A range of products containing PFAS include carpet, cosmetics, textiles, cookware, furniture, and firefighting foam. The proposed legislation allows some exemptions to the firefighting substances, but requires firefighters to report the use within 24 hours to state officials. The House Energy and Environment Committee will hear testimony on the bill in mid-April. The Boulder City Council and the Boulder County Commission will hold a joint hearing tonight to consider a resolution that will allow the formation of a Boulder Public Library District. The City Council will vote on the resolution after the hearing, and the County Commission will place its vote on Thursday. Supporters of the measure say that a library district supported by its own property tax will allow a more stable source of funding for library services that have faced cuts and reductions under municipal control. The Daily Camera reports that if the City Council and the County Commission approve the resolution, a property tax increase supporting the new district will likely be on the November ballot. Both entities will also need to negotiate an intergovernmental agreement and seat a board of trustees. Erie High School hosts a long-awaiting graduation ceremony for a local Vietnam War veteran after 50 years of dedication to his community. KGNU's Athena Robles has more.
Erie High School awarded Vietnam veteran Ron Cardenas his official high school diploma after waiting for 58 years this month. Ron Cardenas joined the U.S. Marines during the height of the Vietnam War in 1964 during his junior year of high school. Despite earning all the necessary credits to graduate while serving in the Vietnam War, he was unable to receive his diploma when he returned to Erie in 1968. Over the years, Ron Cardenas and his family have been lifelong supporters of Erie High School and its community, despite the discrimination Cardenas faced as a member of the Hispanic community while in high school. Erie High School acknowledged Ron Cardenas for his service in the U.S. Marines and for his lifelong commitment to Erie at the special ceremony held earlier this month. For KGNU, I'm Athena Robles.
The Superior Board of Trustees voted unanimously Monday to install the granular activated carbon treatment system to the town's water treatment plant. Since the Marshall Fire, Superior residents have complained that the town's drinking water has a smoky taste and odor. Although both the State Health Department and the Boulder County Public Health have tested the water and have deemed the drinking water safe, the town has consulted an outside contractor to address the issue. The contractor, Corona Environmental Consulting, concluded that the granular activated carbon treatment system will be the best fix for the problem. Due to high winds and low relative humidity for the northeastern Colorado plains, the National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning in effect from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. today. The warning means that for any fire that develops, it will likely spread quickly. Outdoor burning of any kind should be avoided, including cigarette burning and activity that can produce a spark, such as a vehicle chain dragging against a road. Early this morning, firefighters responded to a small half-acre fire in the Carriage Hills neighborhood. The Boulder County Sheriff reports crews have it contained and are mopping it up. There are no injuries or structure loss. Along with gusty winds today, there is a chance of rain showers before 4 p.m. and a small chance of snow in the evening hours for Boulder. Winds will continue in the evening with tonight's lows in the upper 20s, low 30s. Today's highs will be in the upper 50s, low 60s. The current temperature in Boulder is 59 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Fancy a ghost story set in a ghost town? Well, that's what author M. Dressler is serving up in her book, Our Eyes at Night. It's the third novel in her Last Ghost series. Dressler will be presenting her book this evening at the Westminster location of the Tattered Cover Bookstore. M. Dressler joins me live via video conferencing. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So Our Eyes at Night is a ghost story set in a climate-ravaged Utah town in the Four Corners region. The area has essentially run out of water, with the notable exception of an absentee billionaire's compound in a box canyon. How far into the future are you setting this story?
Yeah, well, this is really an alternate universe, I would have to say. So it's not that far in the future. But when I think of it, I think about 5 to 10 years ahead. And so that it will feel rather pressing, rather urgent, some of what's being described in the book.
And why set this thriller in the Four Corners region?
I have lived here for 2 decades and always wanted to set a book here, and particularly a ghost story. I think because this place is rich, right? It is contested ground. It is full of bones, as it were, full of histories and peoples. And I'm terrifically interested in the past, but as you can see, I'm also interested in the future. And so the idea came to me of thinking about the dead moving across this landscape and really looking around and wondering if we, the living, were not leaving it more fit for them, right? We're not being good stewards of the landscape, and perhaps the dead in the future will be more suited to the climate, as it were.
And how much true history is woven into the novel?
Quite a bit. I mean, I set it down in the Moab area, basically. And in my ghost novels, I like to move things around and fictionalize them. So the towns, I change the names of towns and locations. But anyone who's familiar with the Four Corners will recognize accurate geologic history, will recognize places and formations and canyons and local lore. And to me, that's part of the fascination of the genre, right, is mixing the speculative and the ghost story and putting it in really real places, right, which helps us suspend disbelief, right, but also, again, allows us to address really serious issues about life and death, right, at the same time that we're being entertained, right, and held in suspense by a gothic story.
So let's dig in a little bit more to that past answer. This is essentially a tale of hunter and hunted. What felt right about choosing the ghost story genre for this series?
Right. So the basic structure, you're absolutely right, is it's an elemental struggle between a ghost named Emma Finnis and a ghost cleaner. And they have completely opposite worldviews. She absolutely believes in her right as a ghost to persist, right, and continue to exist. Her nemesis, Philip Pratt, is not a villain. He absolutely believes that ghosts need to find peace and the living need to not be tormented by ghosts, and we must respect the boundary between living and dead. But when I put these two very strong, very human characters together, what I discovered is that we can think about all kinds of things like who gets to stand in the light, you know, who gets to be seen in culture, and who do we want to shove in the shadows, and what do we not want to think about? And those, again, are deep and pressing issues that I think don't just relate to a ghost named Emma and a ghost cleaner named Pratt, but that others can relate to. What does it mean when you're forced to be invisible, when you're forced to live in the shadows, when you don't want to? And that's one of the larger questions and themes of the book and of the series.
Finally, you are presenting this book in person this evening at the Tattered Cover Bookstore. What can attendees expect?
So I'd love to go over just the arc of the series so far. There are three books in the series. This is the third. I'll be spending most of my time on this one because it's the newest, but also because it's so close to our own region here. It's in the Four Corners. But give a sense again of the scope and arc and just the wonder and power of the ghost story, not just my ghost stories, but again, that incredible combination of page-turning, chilling suspense, along with, you know, really good writing, I hope, and really deep and important questions that will move our souls, so to speak.
I've been speaking with author M. Dressler. She'll be presenting her latest work, Our Eyes at Night, at 6 p.m. this evening at the Westminster location of the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Using garbage to break ties with Russia. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The cryptocurrency industry, including Bitcoin, is energy intensive, requiring huge amounts of electricity to run numerous arrays of computers in which so-called crypto miners verify transactions. Where that power comes from is creating a power struggle in at least one local community.
In the Finger Lakes area of upstate New York, known for its great wines, natural beauty, and recreational opportunities, the crypto mining company Greenidge is coming under fire, not only for the amount of natural gas it burns, but also the noise and air pollution it creates.
In addition, the plant sucks up almost 140 million gallons of water each day for cooling and to make steam to turn turbines. Then it dumps hot water up to 108 degrees Fahrenheit back into Seneca Lake, endangering aquatic species.
The crypto mining industry faces strong criticism from environmentalists and some politicians over its high carbon footprint. One Bitcoin transaction uses 2,000 kilowatt hours of electricity, enough to power an average household in the U.S. for more than 70 days.
Last week, a campaign led by the Environmental Working Group and Greenpeace USA called Change the Code, Not the Climate, was launched to drastically reduce the amount of power the industry uses. They say it could cut energy demand by 99%.
However, critics claim that most companies won't adopt the code change because they're invested in systems they already use. Sea cucumbers are not vegetables.
They're invertebrates that look like lumpy worms and are related to starfish and urchins.
Sea cucumbers perform an important role in marine environments, using their feet, which look like tentacles around their mouths, to break down tiny particles of algae and recycle nutrients.
But the critters are threatened by poachers. A new study from Michigan State University shows that once thriving populations off Mexico have collapsed because of illegal trafficking, much of it from international criminal syndicates.
There are more than 1,200 known species of sea cucumbers. They're considered a delicacy in Asia and used in traditional medicine. 1 kilogram can sell for hundreds of dollars in Hong Kong.
Protecting sea cucumbers is a challenge. Authorities often lack the resources to patrol the vast areas where the theft occurs, and conservation efforts are difficult since they don't have the same appeal of pandas or baby seals.
Europe depends on Russia for over 40% of its oil and gas supplies. Last week, several European countries asked residents to consume less energy amid growing concerns Moscow could turn off the tap.
While conservation can significantly reduce demand, in the long term, the EU wants to reduce its reliance on Russian gas by 2/3 by the end of this year and stop all imports before 2030.
The plan pushes for more wind and solar, but also calls for garbage not to go to waste.
Biogas, also known as biomethane, is energy produced from a variety of materials or feedstock, including sewage, seaweed, agricultural, and forestry waste, as well as discarded household food and animal manure.
The benefit of biogas is that it prevents rotting materials from ending up in landfills and releasing methane, a potent greenhouse gas. Its downside is that some waste material is coming from crops like corn being grown for energy rather than food, which could exacerbate the world hunger crisis.
Also, the rush to produce more feedstock could lead to deforestation. For that reason, experts say biogas can only be one component of a comprehensive strategy to untether from Russian energy.
And finally, speaking of waste, the food we eat has a water footprint, not only from growing crops and feeding livestock, but also from producing and manufacturing the end product we find on our grocery shelves, a process that can create a lot of wastewater.
But according to researchers in Sweden, that wastewater can be used as fertilizer for growing seaweed to help feed a rising global population. It's estimated that by 2050, 10 billion people will live on Earth, creating a need for sustainably produced protein.
Seaweeds are a good source of minerals and vitamins and also have antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, but they have a lower protein content than other plant-based crops like soybeans.
That is, until you add the food processing wastewater. The researchers found that when land-based seaweed farms were fertilized with the water, the seaweed grew more than 60% faster, and its protein content quadrupled.
For the experiment, they used wastewater from salmon and herring farming, shellfish processing, and oat milk manufacturing. The best part? Some of the seaweed could, in turn, be fed to the fish to make the system completely circular.
That's it for this week in Water. Support comes from GC Green, a veteran, woman, and Native American-owned clean energy and resiliency solutions company. Learn more at gcgreen.com.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
Hi, wonderful KGNU. I just want to say that Thursday night, 5 o'clock, BBC Radio is a repeat of yesterday's news. So I'm sorry it's a repeat, but that's what it is. Thank you.
Hello. I guess my comment is listening, you know, to Pasa la Voz, porque yo hablo español también, es que they are, in this segment I just heard just now, today is Sunday, April 3rd, is that I heard, you know, a criminalization, you know, or like calling cannabis bad. And it's just like the la aumentación de uso de drogas. Y están hablando de cannabis, ¿no? Bueno, dicen marihuana, pero eso es, bueno, ya sabemos que eso es un término que fue creado por el gobierno de los Estados Unidos, ¿sí? Para criminalizar el cannabis, ¿no? Originalmente. So this term was, you know, created and used in a propaganda campaign, right, to criminalize the use of cannabis. And I hear on Pasa la Voz, which I actually really like, that cannabis is really bad, it's ruining the families, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, it's just, me cuesta, you know, it's difficult to hear. And I hope that maybe people could hear this and try to understand that, you know, cannabis use is not the issue. Most likely the issue is probably opiates or prescription drugs or whatever it is. This is the issue, right? It's not cannabis. Anyways, that's my little 2 cents. Mis dos centavitos para la pasada voz, ¿eh? Gracias.
This is Skip in Boulder. Last week, during the morning, Shannon Young had an excellent call-in program on ways to improve KGU. One of the callers stated that the BBC is propaganda, while another stated that it most certainly is not and is quite well done, etc. For the record, though the programs are indeed quite well done and sophisticated, the BBC is indeed government and MI6 control propaganda. The documentation of this C3 articles at thelatest.com, with an underscore between D and latest, see uncovered British reporters who are spooks. In the second paragraph, John le Carré, the spy novelist who worked for MI6 from 1960 to 64, states that the British Secret Service control large parts of the press. At opendemocracy.net, see, the BBC is neither independent or impartial. It's an interview with Tom Mills on his book, The BBC, The Myth of Public Service. At veteranstoday.com, see, London spy school turns out fake journalists to sell endless war. This is on how King's College trains journalists and spies side by side and has major intelligence operatives as instructors.
Hi, KGNU. Thank you so much. I just re-listened to the Living Dialogues, and it's amazing. It's a great title because it is still alive. It is a living dialogue. This was a repeat from 2007, but it is nonetheless prescient because they're talking about humanity being on a critical point of evolution, and independent news and the adversarial ratings that happens in the corporate news stream. If it bleeds, it leads. They're talking about confirmation bias, and KTNU's not biased, are they? thank you so much for deeply listening to everyone.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Athena Robles, Alexis Kenyon, Rosanna Longobetter, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC. But first, a look at what's coming up on this week's Connections Show.